From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Donald Trump told the New York Times in a phone interview that the investigation into Russians' hacking of the U.S. election is a political witch hunt. This was this morning, just hours before his scheduled meeting today with the intelligence officials behind that investigation.
And also this morning, Trump tweeted the U.S. might initially have to pay for that Great Wall on the border before Mexico does. And the president-elect got into a Twitter spat with the new Celebrity Apprentice host, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Trump tweeted, "I'm a ratings machine." The Terminator responded, "I hope you work for all Americans as much as you worked for your ratings."
It could be a new reality show when reality show hosts fight and one of them is president. Let's bring in our roundtable for a look at the week. April Ryan is White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks and author of the new book, At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White. April, welcome back.
It's great to be back, especially with all of this stuff going on.
I know. Rebecca Cinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. I know you have a lot you've been thinking about as well. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
And April, you start. We had those extraordinary hearings yesterday, the intelligence officials speaking to Congress, and Republicans seeming to speak to Trump through these top intelligence officers who were testifying. In effect, telling Trump, you know, this hacking was real. It could have happened to Republicans. Julian Assange, who leaked the hacked material, is not your friend. Your thoughts on where we are?
It's a very interesting time. As a reporter, we've never seen anything like this. To have a president-elect come in basically challenging the intelligence community of this nation. Not only that, I mean, yes, we know that the intelligence that this country has is not always as accurate as you would like. Some of it may be faulty, but guess what? They've been doing it for a long time, and they've had some successes, and yes, some things may not have gone as planned, but for a sitting, for someone coming in to be the next sitting president, it does not bode well for him in that office, as well as give confidence to the broader community, the nation, when he's questioning our own intelligence officials.
But Rebecca, I mean, not one Republican backed him up, although some did point out, and it is true that some of these committees were formed after 9/11. That was considered, it was missed by the intelligence community. There was, of course, the false reports of weapons of mass destruction in the lead into the Iraq War. But do you think that Donald Trump is going to reconfigure the intelligence world as he said he would?
You know, it's going to be very interesting to see right now, particularly when you're looking at the Republican foreign policy establishment and intelligence advisors. There are people who are backing away that Donald Trump desperately needs in his corner. You have, of course, James Woolsey leaving the transition team, the former director of the CIA. That was someone who had given a bit of public weight to Donald Trump's views on the intelligence community. And to have him gone and leaving in what seems to be a pretty dramatic fashion, leaving very publicly and suddenly isn't great news for Donald Trump. We have to, of course, note that Trump's transition committee denies that he has these plans at this moment. Then again, you have to say it's very convenient to have a story like that, the idea circulating right now, to have that in the minds of the intelligence community, that this is a possibility, whether or not it's something that's actually being weighed.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk for a moment about all the change that's going on in Washington now between administrations as we're going through the transition. Because this week we also heard from President Obama. He's giving his sort of last speeches here. Here he is thanking the U.S. military.
"Of all the privileges of this office, and there are many, I will miss Air Force One, I will miss Marine One. But I can stand before you today and say that there has been no greater privilege and no greater honor than serving as the commander-in-chief of the greatest military in the history of the world."
So President Obama there giving his final salute, so to speak, as commander-in-chief to the U.S. military. We also see today, though, that the Trump transition team isn't wasting any time. They told U.S., quote, political ambassadors today that they had to resign by Inauguration Day. So, I mean, April, tell us, I mean, how is this transition going?
It's interesting. We've never seen a transition like this. And let's start with one piece. I've covered this White House. It'll be 20 years, January 13th, next week. And I've seen several transitions, and never in some of the worst times, we've never seen the dignity of a president or an administration on the table or in question. And now and the president-elect kind of takes their time in doing things or lets them finish finish out, lets the president finish out their term. And President Obama is president until 12 noon, January 20th, 2017. And it looks like, you know, things are moving as if Donald Trump were president right now. And it's very interesting. And there's still some agencies that I'm hearing from that have yet to hear from people in the transition. But there are articles in place and laws now that are in place that even if they have not heard from someone, there is a paperwork trail to be able to follow, to be able to help assist in a smooth transition to keep the democracy going. This is a very interesting and unprecedented time.
Well, Rebecca, April points out rightly that, as many have said, Donald Trump is, we almost have two presidents right now. And in the past, it's always been that the president-elect kind of waits and organizes his administration before speaking out as much as this one has. But then you have on PBS NewsHour, Vice President Joe Biden saying that Trump should grow up. Is that side of the equation demeaning itself in that as well, or?
Well, we're starting to see a few cracks starting to form in the kind of, you know, the united front. We had this great moment very early in the transition, President Obama kind of saying he would do everything he can to make Trump a successful president, Trump offering praise for President Obama. And of course, you've seen that start to break down. It seems almost inevitable. And particularly, President Obama has been raising questions, of course, about Trump's processing of the intelligence about the Russian hack. And so he's been saying he hopes that Trump reconsiders. Trump, of course, has increasingly doubled down on his position.
Well, you know, can I step in for
sure.
1 second? I don't know if it's the chicken or the egg scenario, really.
Right.
I believe that this president has done and is still trying to keep a smooth transition. But it's kind of hard to have a smooth transition when you the president-elect is calling him for advice and then tweeting out, I don't like this and I don't like that. And as a sitting president, and you're worried about your legacy and you're worried about the things that you're doing to keep a straight face. I mean, I've heard that, you know, when Donald Trump calls, you know, we're doing good. You know, you're doing a great job. We thank you for this. And then in the same breath on Twitter, he'll say something else. It's kind of hard. I think the breakdown may be from the other side, not necessarily from President Obama. He's now starting to respond, but it's kind of a chicken or egg situation.
Well, and of course, Trump followers were really upset when President Obama said in that interview that he thought he might have won this election. That was that felt like a slap in their face. But I talk about the Twitter presidency that we are about to be in.
The Twitter.
An incoming White House Press Secretary, Sean Spicer, told former Obama advisor David Axelrod at an event this week that when he gets up in the morning, he doesn't even know. You know, Trump's tweets are news to him, too.
I do truly look at it as an exciting piece of the job where you're looking up.
There's no doubt it's exciting.
and it adds an element where you know that he can drive something, drive a message and influence people in a way that that hasn't done before, and I think Obama did some.
Rebecca Sinderbrand, take that, because his followers would say, you know, after Trump tweeted criticism of General Motors for making cars in Mexico, Ford announced it would invest in a plant in Michigan instead of moving jobs to Mexico. Does Sean Spicer have a point? Maybe that is the way we operate from here on out.
Well, it's as he noted, it's going to be very exciting by whatever definition of the word you want to use.
But is it effective?
Well, and that's the question. You have this situation now, which those of us who've been covering Washington for a long time have not seen before, where you get a message from the president-elect's team, and you cannot be certain that that is actually the official message. The president-elect could come out and say something completely different, and has several times contradicted what his aides have had to say. And so it's very difficult to get a coherent message out when it's fractured. The other issue is, of course, he seems to have a flood the zone approach when it comes to news management. You know, he comes out in the morning and does a flurry of tweets this morning, half a dozen different topics, wildly disparate, including The Apprentice. And so, you know, that's something where if you are an administration that is trying to get a comprehensive single message out and you want to own a news cycle, it's not clear that that's a particularly effective method. He'd have to fundamentally reconfigure the way he approaches the news cycle.
Well, tweets aren't policy, and others have pointed that out. A few jobs here and there are not, you know, making up for the thousands that we need to have.
Yeah, and there needs to be a secretary of damage control, Twitter damage control, because he, you never know. I mean, this is the this man's going to be president of the United States, and he goes out and greets the American people first thing in the morning. Oh, let me check my tweet from the president. And it could be something just totally outside of the bounds, and you just don't know. And I mean, this is something, it's no filter. He's going straight to the American public, and it's sad that his own own staff, own cabinet, they won't know what he thinks when he does it.
Well, Rebecca, in the last couple seconds we have, January 20th is fast approaching, but Republican Governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, said he's not going to attend the inauguration. Quick thoughts.
It'll be interesting to see who shows up and who doesn't. Of course, two of the most visible faces at that inauguration, Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Yes. April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks, author of the new book At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White. And that was Rebecca Cinderbrand wrapping us up, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Boy, I don't think it's ever been this exciting in this time between the election and inauguration. April, Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now. The attack on a disabled white teenager by four young blacks who broadcast it live on Facebook is opening yet another divide. The four defendants are in court today, charged with hate crimes, accused of kidnapping the victim, who reportedly knew one of the suspects and met him for a sleepover. But then over the course of several hours, his hands were bound, his mouth taped. On the video, his captors beat him, force him to drink toilet water, and shower him with racist invective about whites and Donald Trump. After the attack, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who is black and an outspoken conservative, said this to Sean Hannity about the ongoing epidemic of violence in Chicago.
Here's what's wrong in Chicago. It's not the Chicago Police Department. It's the fact that Mayor Emanuel has allowed Black Lives Matter and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, to run the Chicago Police Department.
Well, there is even a hashtag, BLM kidnapping, laying the blame on the movement. DeRay McKesson is a leader of the Black Lives Matters movement. He's based in Baltimore. And DeRay, Glenn Beck is saying to his Twitter followers, demand justice for the beating of this disabled Trump supporter by BLM, Black Lives Matter. Now, we have no idea if this young man supported Donald Trump, but your thoughts on the accusation that his tormentors were part of your group.
So remember that the movement began as a call to end violence, and that call remains the same call today, that we took to the streets because the police were being violent in communities, not only in Ferguson, but in Baltimore and in cities across the country. So when I think about this tragic incident that happened, it's important that there's justice and that we will follow the process out. You know, I have more questions than answers at this point. But again, it's clear that the movement like had nothing to do with this and that the call has been to end violence from every step.
Yeah, but DeRay, I got to remind you, maybe I don't need to remind you, that we first met and you first shot to prominence when on CNN with Wolf Blitzer, you refused to condemn the violence in the streets after accusations of police violence. You know, is this perhaps that coming to haunt you, not condemning violence in certain occasions by blacks?
No, so what I said to Wolf was what I believe today, right? That I'm more interested in broken spines and broken windows, and Freddie Gray's spine was snapped. And we do make a distinguishment between, or we do distinguish between violence, which is harm inflicted towards people, and property damage, which is what happened here in Baltimore. This is a very different situation, that this is clearly that this is wrong. Like, people shouldn't have to endure or be subject to what happened to this young man. And just like people in community should not be subject to violent police departments.
Well, and we should say that a police spokesperson has said that he is not even sure if this was racist as much as it was an attack on someone, still a hate crime, because he has special needs. And Pat Brady, a former chair of the Illinois Republican Party and a former prosecutor, said the attack shouldn't be viewed as having some larger meaning. He says, we can acknowledge that we've had some really bad political discourse, but this is about four sick kids who probably can't even spell Trump. But still, can you maybe now have new insight into how police across the country feel when they're broad-brushed by what they think are outlier incidents of police brutality against blacks?
Yeah, so the police and private citizens have two very different functions in society, that the police are endowed in cities across the country with the power to kill on behalf of the state or inflict harm on behalf of the state. What is clear is that these four people have swiftly been arrested, that they are being processed. There are police officers who have killed people in broad daylight who nothing has ever happened to them. So this is not apples to apples. This is apples to oranges. If the police continue to terrorize people in communities and not be held accountable, what we see time and time again, especially with people of color, is that the justice system moves very quick to hold them accountable for their actions. I wish that the justice system moved as quick to hold police officers accountable.
Yeah, but look, you've got people like conservative author Mike Cernovich saying it was his activism, his call for the charges that led to the charges. It never would have happened. And that BLM kidnapping hashtag is out there. Has your movement taken a hit?
So what's clear is that there have always been people who have tried to damage the reputation of civil rights activists and organizers for decades. And that's what we see with this. By linking this tragic and heinous incident to the movement, they are trying to drum up sort of a counter to this narrative that we believe in justice and equity. And we won't be sidetracked by this. This isn't the first time they've done it. And we know we're staying focused. And like I said, the movement began as a call to end violence, and that call remains a call today.
President Obama was asked about race relations yesterday when he spoke with Chicago's ABC affiliate WLS. Let's listen.
For the most part, race relations have gotten better. But I think what we've seen over the last several years when it comes to tensions between police and communities, the internet, horrific hate crimes of the sort that we appear to have seen
on Facebook,
it's terrible.
Yeah, saying that it's terrible, but also saying that he believes race relations have gotten better. Do you agree?
Yeah, better doesn't mean that we've reached a point where it is as good as it should be. So are things better than they were 100 years ago? Yes. Are they better than they were 200 years ago? Yeah. Are they better than they were 50 years ago? Yes. But does that mean that we don't still live in a context where voting rights are being gutted in cities across the country, where the police are still killing people, where there's a huge income disparity? So yes, better is true, but better does not mean we are where we need to be.
Duran McKesson of the Black Lives Matter movement, thank you.
Thank you.
The name David French is one that's little known outside political circles. But for a few weeks last summer, many conservative activists nationwide were saying the lawyer and writer living in Middle Tennessee was the guy to stop Donald Trump. French's harsh criticisms of the president-elect unleashed a torrent of online abuse, but French says he has no intention of backing down now. Chaz Sisk of Here Now contributor Nashville Public Radio sat down with him recently and has our story.
A wave of hate has engulfed David French and his family for most of the past year. Threats that intruded deep into his family's lives.
We had a weird incident where somebody literally broke into a phone call my wife was on with her father and began yelling profanities, supporting Trump.
Also gruesome videos of suicides and murders posted to his wife's blog, and depictions of his daughter, whom his family adopted from Ethiopia, being tortured. What brought it on? French is a writer for National Review, an icon of conservatism, and throughout last year's election cycle, he repeatedly attacked the self-described alt-right, a movement that he calls racist and vicious. To those people, going after Trump makes him a traitor.
You know, when you're talking about fringe characters, sometimes they get angrier at people that they think are betraying their cause than they are at the other side.
French accuses alt-right activists of attempting to intimidate him into silence. So he alerted local police to the threats. French and his family also went over security measures, including firearms. But for the most part, they've strived to maintain normalcy.
We didn't buy new weapons. I mean, we're pretty well stocked up as it is. No, it's just a matter of how often do you carry? Do you go from sometimes when you think you might be in a more dangerous place to always? And you go to always.
That fight has propelled French from obscurity to a national figure. That's despite living and working out of the small Middle Tennessee community of Zion, a crossroads that dates back two centuries, centered around a conservative Presbyterian church. French, his wife, and their three school-aged children are members. Living in such a community helps him as a writer. Too many conservative commentators are based in Washington or New York, he says.
You know, there were pundits all over America writing about Donald Trump who didn't know a single Donald Trump voter. I mean, if you're living in D.C., you know, the most you're probably going to meet is somebody who's willing to support him if he got the nomination, but he was their last choice. That would be that most enthusiastic Trump supporter who wasn't on the campaign payroll that you would encounter.
His prominence hit a crescendo in early June. That's when conservative writer Bill Kristol floated French as a dark horse alternative to Trump. Kristol pointed to French's conservative credentials, his degree from Harvard Law School, his service in Iraq with the Army Reserve, and his roots in Middle America. French ultimately turned down the chance to run for president, so the mantle eventually passed to Evan McMullen, a former intelligence officer living in Utah who ran as an independent. That's who French voted for, but plenty of people in his church and community went for Trump, even close friends who knew French and his family were under threat. Does that change the way you think of them in any way, or sort of?
Look, I mean, here's the deal, you know, and this is something that I say again and again, is if you walk into a voting booth and you're looking at three names, and those names are Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Gary Johnson, I'm not going to think ill of any person who looks at those three names and goes, you know what, Donald Trump's not my favorite, but amongst those three, I think he'd do better. I totally get that.
French believes Republican voters like the fighter in Donald Trump. His slogan, Make America Great Again, was an easy message to grasp, like the Obama campaign's promises of hope and change. But he thinks what really got evangelicals to turn out was Trump's promise to appoint Supreme Court justices who oppose abortion.
You know, if you're pro-life, you're looking at abortion and you're saying, look, this is the intentional killing of an innocent human being that is sanctioned and permitted by law. It's a monstrous injustice. Monstrous. This was the number one counter-argument to me. And it's the one that came the closest to persuading me to vote for him, to be honest.
French, however, believes Trump has built his appeal on a nationalist identity that excludes many people, like his daughter, born in Africa. French hopes he's wrong about Trump. He hopes the president-elect will show a different side once in the White House. But if that doesn't turn out to be the case, French says he's prepared to criticize and endure the wave of hate once again. For Here and Now, I'm Chaz Sisk.
Yesterday, Donald Trump tweeted, Toyota Motors said we'll build a new plant in Baja, Mexico to build Corolla cars for U.S. No way! Build plant in U.S. or pay big border tax. It's just the latest in a series of tweets to corporations, from Boeing and Lockheed Martin to this week General Motors. Some companies are publicly changing course. Other companies are privately going on the defense, planning a playbook in case a presidential tweet focuses on them. Here now, media analyst John Carroll is here with some thoughts. John, how unusual is this?
This is very unusual. It's not unusual for people to be on social media affecting a brand image, but usually it's consumers, it's competitors. It's very rarely the president-elect, so it raises the stakes exponentially.
Well, and as you say, across the board, social media has really made it difficult for companies to hold on to their brand when other people can define it for you.
Right. They used to have really almost absolute control. News media were there, but mostly it was what they communicated about their brand. It's not that way anymore.
So now reportedly companies are fighting back by forming these quick response crisis teams just in case President-elect Trump focuses on them. The New York Times reported on H&R Block putting out a new ad campaign. Now, during the presidential campaign, Trump said he hoped to put H&R Block out of business. You know, he'd have a simpler tax code.
Right.
You wouldn't need them. The company says they actually took a hit from that. And now they have this new TV spot with actor John Hamm. He's at a food table on a film set. He picks up a series of donuts while talking to the stunned young woman there.
Okay, let me explain. This is your tax return.
Okay.
Now, there are many right ways to fill out this tax return. The IRS will accept them all. One of them gets you the most money back. Isn't that the one you want?
That's the one I want.
Your thoughts?
So he eats a donut with a lot of sprinkles on it. That's the H&R Block one. I mean, yeah, the spot's okay, but the idea of going back and trying to reclaim your image is the right thing to do. H&R Block wants to go out and essentially take back control of their image from Donald Trump, who made them seem sort of peripheral and unnecessary.
Right. Here's what we do. We tell you which one to take, right?
Right.
But it's tricky. Do you take on a divisive president? Do you grovel? Because either thing you do could anger your customers.
Right. I'm not sure there's any one right way to do it. Lockheed Martin and Boeing basically caved and said, okay, we'll hold the cost down on Air Force One and the F-35 fighter jet. GM was sort of reserved in their response. They said, we don't sell that many cruisers. Trump had criticized them for sending Chevy Cruises up to the U.S. from Mexico. They said, we don't sell that many, and they haven't really done anything beyond that.
Vanity Fair fought back. Remember when Trump, they had a negative review of a restaurant in one of his buildings, and he said the magazine was dead. They fought back. They had a banner on their website saying the magazine Donald Trump doesn't want you to read. What happened there?
Well, that worked out great. They increased their subscriptions by about 40,000. 2,000, according to one report. And Donald Trump is actually meeting with Anna Wintour, the editor of Vogue, and some other Condé Nast people, including the editor of Vanity Fair today. I'd like to be on fly on the wall on that one. Yeah,
we'll fly on so many. Meanwhile, you know, there's the consultants who say corporations should wear WWTD bracelets. What would Trump do? Is that your advice, too? Just be thinking about it?
I think you need to be vigilant. You need to be prepared. But mostly, you need to be quick in your response.
Don't let it go. John Carroll here now, media analyst, mass communication professor at Boston University. We'll link you to his campaign outsider blog at herenow.org. John, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Tupac Shakur's 1995 number one single, California Love. Shakur is part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class of 2017, and he's only the sixth hip-hop star to get the nod from the Hall of Fame. Many fans and critics say it's about time, and in fact, there's been a surge of interest in the earliest days of hip-hop and its enormous influence on popular music and culture. Ben Westhoff is author of Original Gangstas, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. And he joins us from KWMU in St. Louis. Hi there, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, explain to me why you've written that Tupac Shakur deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as Elvis Presley, The Beatles, Bob Dylan, Madonna, and Michael Jackson.
I don't think it's overstatement to say that Tupac is the most important rapper ever. He's not necessarily the best rapper. You might think of someone like Biggie Smalls, his arch rival. But his contributions include the message that he brought of social empowerment, anti-police brutality, and he really lifted a lot of people. And 20 years after his death, he's still as popular as any rapper working.
Hmm. Well, Tupac joins several other hip-hop groups and individuals who have already been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, including N.W.A., Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Run DMC, Beastie Boys, Public Enemy. I mean, is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame the right place for them? Or hip-hop being the massive movement and cultural force that it is, should their honorees go someplace else?
I do think hip-hop needs to have its own really viable Hall of Fame. But in the meantime, I think that rappers do belong in the Hall of Fame for rock and roll just because, you know, and Ice Cube put this well last year when N.W.A. was inducted, that rock and roll is kind of a spirit almost more than anything. And that same spirit, kind of the anti-authority, you know, the kids expressing themselves in a musical way that has a populist element, that is really carried on with hip-hop.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ground that your book covers, and that's sort of the origin and the earliest days of West Coast rap, because obviously the East Coast and New York hip-hop and rap had been going on, but social conditions in the West Coast weren't all that different, but they were also unique in a certain way, because we have the crack epidemic, the gangs in Los Angeles and L.A. County. There's major headlining events like the beating of Rodney King, the O.J. trial, just a lot of stuff going on in Los Angeles at the time that this music was really taking hold. Talk about the importance of that.
Definitely. I think at the time, New York was the epicenter of the hip-hop world. And when L.A. started making music, they were so looked down upon that to some people it was like it may as well have been the South. It was so out of their orbit. But the conditions on the ground in L.A., all the things you talked about, really led the rappers to rap about a whole different new subject matter. And the way they told it, you know, we call them gangster rappers now, but they thought of themselves as reality rappers. And people like Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E, they thought of themselves as kind of street reporters who were telling it like it really was.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a little bit of the music. This is from N.W.A. It's a clip from their song Gangsta Gangsta. And I'm in it. My man Trey knock you out in a minute with the right, left, you're toothless. And then you say, damn, they ruthless. We make you say it again. Damn. And W is messing up the program. And then you realize we don't care. We don't just say no. We're too busy saying yeah. About drinking straight out the eight bottle. Tell the truth. So, Ben, in your book, you write that gangster rap, West Coast rap, was this Trojan horse, that's what you called it, of catchy beats and clever rhymes that served as an art form, in your words, that made black life a permanent part of the American conversation. Now, how did it exactly do that?
I think for music to succeed, any kind of music, the lyrics are kind of secondary. And what really gets people to like music is the beat. And so in the case of someone like Dr. Dre, who is the producer of a lot of this music, his beats are so mesmerizing that he was able to kind of sneak in some of these messages to places that they might not normally hear them, you know, like dance floors. And Ice Cube was the more political member of N.W.A., and he wrote songs like F the Police, mm-hmm. primarily. And, you know, he was able to get that message onto dance floors because of these amazing beats.
So can we talk about that song for a second? There's really no part of it that we can play on the radio right now. But that song, F the Police, is full of this explosive anger about how they believed the police saw them. I think that was one of the things that I responded to most powerfully. When I heard the song, it was like, wow, that was a point of view that we just hadn't heard in music before.
Yeah, it was a totally subversive kind of thing, and there wasn't a lot of precedent. I mean, in the 80s at the time, you had a lot of popular black entertainers like Michael Jackson and Prince, but this sort of really strident message was not something that you heard on the radio. And I think that's NWA's great legacy, is they opened up for other rappers and artists of all types to be able to say what was really on their mind.
Mm. Well, let's hear a little bit more of the music of the era. This is NWA again, and you had mentioned it before, but it's one of their most famous songs, possibly their most famous song, Straight Outta Compton.
Straight Outta Compton is a crazy brother named Ice Cube from the stupid dope gang with an attitude. When I'm caught off, I got a sawed off. Kick knowledge and bodies on hauled off. You too, boy, if you get with me, the police are gonna have to come and get me off your back. That's how I'm going out.
So, Ben, let me ask you. I mean, we've talked about how Tupac, NWA, and other groups and hip-hop artists like them were sort of, they were truth tellers about the African-American experience, the black experience in Los Angeles at the time. But on the other hand, at the same time, they were, you know, they were glorifying violence. They were glorifying misogyny. Those are the things that made them very controversial. Talk about that for a moment. I mean, is that still a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. These are things that fans of the music really have to reconcile. In my reporting for Original Gangsters, I found that Dr. Dre, who'd already been accused of beating three other women, also beat the mother of three of his children in the mid-80s, and she accused him also while she was pregnant.
Hmm. And what about sort of the other concern that many people have voiced over a generation or two now about the culture of violence that seems to be celebrated in the music, and a lot of people saying, look, as good as it might be, we shouldn't be, you know, elevating or venerating pop artists who are sort of saying it's okay for folks to be singing about the police in the way they did.
This was the kind of thing that in the 80s when NWA came out was all the media was talking about.
Yeah.
But I think nowadays the odd thing is that gangster rap kind of won, and that you don't really have these sort of serious music critics who question whether rappers have the right to be talking about these subjects, because I think it's become sort of a legitimized form of protest music, for better or worse.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to how the music has evolved, how we hear that protest in modern day hip hop, because we've got a clip here from Kendrick Lamar, of course, huge and popular hip hop artist right now. This is a clip from his song Hood Politics off his 2015 album To Pimp a Butterfly.
His name's on paper, you snitched all summer. Streets don't fail me now. They tell me it's a new gang in town. From Compton to Congress, set tripping all around. Ain't nothing new but a fluid new Democrats and red blood against red state versus a blue state. Which one you governing?
So Kendrick Lamar has been fearless in being political in his music. But do you see modern hip hop, the hip hop of 2017, being as politically inspired as the gangster rap of the 80s and 90s was?
I think in some ways, yeah, it does have a strong political message. And I think a lot of that was inspired by NWA and people like Ice Cube and Tupac. I think if you look at Kendrick, if you look at people like YG, there have been a lot of rappers like Killer Mike from Run the Jewels and people like Young Jeezy who have really made their voices heard.
Hmm. Well, that's Ben Westhoff, author of Original Gangstas, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. Ben, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
This is Here and Now. A group of storms have been hammering much of California this week, and it's likely to continue this weekend. Flash flood warnings were issued in some regions of the state, and in the Sierra Nevada, up to 7 feet of snow have already fallen. Scientists say these storms are connected to a weather phenomenon called atmospheric rivers. Here to explain is Marty Ralph, research meteorologist and director of the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He joins us via Skype. Marty, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, first of all, can you tell us how are these atmospheric rivers formed? What exactly are they?
There are regions in the atmosphere in the lowest, say, 10,000 feet above the ground where the air is really moist, lots of water vapor, and the winds are very strong, and they form up into these long, narrow regions, narrow by global standards. They're a couple hundred miles wide, maybe a couple thousand miles long. And they form up as part of the big cyclones that develop in the atmosphere in the winter.
So it's really like a river of very fast-moving air. Is that a fair way to describe them?
It's really like a river of water vapor in the sky.
Okay. And so what are the effects then when these atmospheric rivers form?
Well, once they form up, they're transporting an amount of water vapor that's equivalent to, say, 20 Mississippi rivers worth of liquid water. So you can see how important they are to the water supply in many parts of the world.
Because that water eventually falls in the form of rain or snow precipitation.
That's right. When an atmospheric river reaches something that forces the air to go upwards, the water vapor can condense and form rain and snow. And in the west coast of the U.S., you know, mountains do that work of forcing the air upward. And the conditions in the atmospheric river are just perfect meteorologically for forming heavy rain and snow.
Now, how common are they? I mean, how common are they, first of all, in California?
On average, we get about 10 of them in Northern California each year. On average, each one lasts about a day. And the drought we've had the last several years, we've only gotten 3 or 4 atmospheric rivers per year. And in a very wet year, we get 10 or 15 or more.
I see. So they are really important. Okay. Now, so you mentioned the drought. What effect could this atmospheric river have on the, I mean, the drought's been going on for years in California, but given the amount of precipitation that could fall, could it have a positive effect?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, if you go back to March of last year, we started chipping away at the drought through a series of 3 atmospheric river storms that hit within a 2-week period in Northern California and dropped about 25% of the total precipitation for the year. That helped break the drought in Northern California, and now drought conditions are over up there. And for those in the West, many people know that the water supplies for Southern California largely come out of Northern California. So even if Southern California is relatively dry, we really depend on that water from the north.
How much precipitation or snowfall or rainfall is California expecting to see this weekend?
Well, the official forecasts from the National Weather Service over the next 7 days are over 20 inches of liquid equivalent up in the Sierra Nevada, 10 to 15 inches in coastal mountains. These are largely north of the LA Basin, like up into the Bay Area and Northern California. Some sites, I expect the wettest could receive as much as 30 inches of rain.
30 inches of rain. Okay, so when you said liquid equivalent a little bit earlier, I'm also seeing that in the Sierra Nevadas, they could see up to 15 feet of snow.
Yeah, much of that at the highest altitudes will fall as snow. And on average, it's about a 10-to-1 ratio of snow to rain. But in the Sierra, if you're ever from out here, you know about Sierra cement, it might be more like 5-to-1.
Now, is there a potential downside to so much precipitation being caused by this atmospheric river happening at once or in a very short period of time? Because, I mean, maybe the snowpack is good for the mountains, but, you know, if all that rain's falling, a lot of it's going to just sort of run off and perhaps not be captured by reservoirs and just not be useful long term for the state of California. Is that a concern?
Well, the big challenge is that basically these atmospheric rivers represent a double-edged sword. In a dry initial condition where the land is dry and the rivers aren't high, you know, the rain is very beneficial from these atmospheric rivers, you know, primarily. Once we get very saturated, rivers get full, maybe the reservoirs are filling up, and we get a sequence of atmospheric rivers that are strong and long-lasting, that's the formula for major flooding.
You know, earlier you said that in normal years, these atmospheric river events are pretty common in California. But nevertheless, I kind of detect a slight note of excitement in your voice for this one coming up this weekend. Is it still an exciting thing for you?
Oh, absolutely. We're discovering. It's one of the beautiful things about science. We're learning all the time. We have research projects underway to try to better understand these storms. And, you know, one of those results has been that about half of Northern California's annual rainfall comes in these atmospheric river type events. And that in the western U.S., we have the most variable climate from year to year for precipitation. So we really depend on these type of storms. And now that we understand that, this is the type of storm to look for. We're focused, like laser focused, on this phenomena, and we're developing models to forecast them better. It's a very exciting time, in fact, yes.
Well, Marty Ralph is the director of the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's away. This is Here and Now.